Coming up on today's episode, the SN10 explosion is solved. We may be one step closer to warp drive, and Canoe with their new truck is the latest out of thousands of Tesla killers out there.
Yay.
Let's get ludicrous. And welcome to Our Ludicrous Future. This is the podcast where we talk about all the cool future stuff that's happening today. It's going to make tomorrow totally ludicrous. I'm Joe Scott, and I can't control the volume of my voice.
Why, hello. It is me, Tim Dodd, the everyday astronaut from Mars Studio B down here in South Texas. And with us is... Actually, I want to do it like NPR. Hi, it's me, Tim Dodd, the everyday astronaut from coming to you live today from our Mars Studio B studio here in lovely South Texas. And with us is Benjamin Solins.
Hey guys, it's Ben Solins here. Out
Why
California.
Are we getting quieter?
Just
this is terrible.
What's happening, y'all? It's Ben Solins from Answers with Joe YouTube channel. And as with us always, we have our Discord family as well. How are you guys doing today, Discord?
Fam. Discord fam.
I like going Rowdy, Silly Billy, Steve, Supermosh, the Anti-Corporation, Tian.
I think we have some new Mystic people in here.
Nicholas. Yeah, we got a lot of you guys. Joel and Karadav.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome, welcome.
Captain Kirk. Casper,
and if you guys want to be one of the cool cats or kittens that are listening and watching live, including the setup and teardown of this this show we have here, you can learn more, sign up, join the family at olfpod.com/Patreon. And with that, guys, let's start the show. Vamos a empezar.
Well, we probably need one more little, statement from Mr. Joe.
Oh, Joe. Well, yeah. Okay, so there's a little bit of construction going on in my house right now. We're doing some of it is repairing storm damage, but it was stuff that we kind of wanted to do anyway. We're just kind of like putting in a patio. Our previous patio enclosure got kind of ruined, so. If there's some noise, they seem to be on a lunch break right now, which is good, but there might be some noise in a little bit. There might be some dogs yapping. So just forewarning, just letting you know.
As we go through all the stories here, guys, if you don't have time or don't have the desire to sit and listen through the whole thing, you can check the timestamps in the description and just jump over to that segment as well. So a little time saver for you on your Friday. So... where do we want to start, guys?
Maybe
how is everybody doing? We never check in with each other anymore. We never talk. How you guys doing?
Stressed.
Tim's
but
tired.
Also
still
tired and stressed. I've been working on something crazy that I haven't been able to talk about at all publicly. I'm very stressed. How about you guys?
I'm turning into Gran Torino is makes me angry lately. Like people selling JPEGs for $69 million. I don't know why I'm angry. I should be happy for that guy, whoever he is. But yeah, I just look at this and I just go, what is happening to the world? I don't understand it. And I'm just going to retire, I think, is what I'm going to do. I'm ready to retire. Yep. There, Gran Torino. There he is. That's me. I think Joe is there. Now me and Joe can commiserate together. We're both standing on our porches telling people to get off our lawn. Mm-hmm. That's, you know, we're both there
Perfect.
Together.
The metaphorical lawn.
Well, we know Joe is always tired and stressed, so let's move on to... We don't care about your feelings. Joe, should we talk about why SN10 failed?
Yes, because I've been curious about this. I haven't heard
this
it,
is
when you said that you had
because it blew up. Duh. Answer.
So for those of you that don't remember, SN10 did land, and it did land in one piece, and then 8 minutes later, Starship SN10 blew up. Now, obviously, the actual reason for blowing up, we still don't know the exact answer on why it blew up, but it landed way too hard. It landed at about 22, 22 kilometers an hour, I think. Someone remind me, or 10 meters per second. So I think that's about 22 miles an hour. So almost 36 kilometers an hour. It came down pretty hard. So we got the answer on why it came down so fast, because it clearly they, you know, if they can control this thing like they're supposed to be able to, it should not be coming down that fast, and it should not be exploding imminently afterwards. So so Elon said at one point he said SN10 engine was low on thrust due probably to partial helium ingestion from fuel header tank. Impact of 10 meters per second, crushed legs and part of the skirt, multiple fixes in the work for SN11. That was great right there. Like, I would have been pretty happy with that. That's a nice statement that gives us a really decent amount of insight there. But it doesn't stop there. That's not all.
Wait, there's so, more.
So Chris B from NASA Spaceflight was tweeting that this is a tricky one, given that they had changed helium pressurization was added on SN9 to mitigate what happened from SN8. Because remember, SN8 had that problem where the header tank had an issue. The solution was use helium as a back pressure. We've talked about this on the show quite a bit, where they switched the back pressure gas from an autogenous pressure, which means you'd either use gaseous methane or gaseous oxygen in their respective tanks, to switching to helium, which is inert. And we didn't exactly know. A lot of us had speculated that it could have been and I've mentioned this on the show again, it could have been phase change, a situation where that is one of the big problems with sloshing and with tanks is, and autogenous pressurization, is you can create these pockets of, you can trap a gas bubble and have it instantly flash freeze and bye-bye tank, because the pressure change. So Elon said to that, he replied, fair point. If autogenous pressurization had been used, CH4 bubbles would most likely have reverted to liquid. That's exactly what we're talking about here, where if you capture a gas bubble inside of a cryogenic tank, you know, and surrounded entirely by cryogenic liquid, it will instantly flash freeze and turn, or not freeze, but instantly flash phase change into a liquid, shrink in size, and therefore it can cavitate. It shrink the tank and destroy. which is likely exactly what happened. Cavitate, yeah. So he said that to the response to this, helium in the header was used to prevent ullage collapse from slosh, which happened in the prior flight. My fault for approving sounded good at the time. So we do have the full picture here, that this really was that on SN8, when it ran low on header tank, it's because there was some slosh that collapsed or damaged the header tank to create a low pressure environment inside the header tank, which then was not able to feed the engine for the landing burn. That's why SN8 failed. SN9 failed for a different reason, because an engine did not light successfully. SN10 failed though. So SN10 failed because it ingested helium. So it's still an issue, because so basically I asked then, are there baffles in future designs to prevent slosh? And he said, there were baffles, but one may have acted like a straw to suck bubbles in from above the liquid gas level. Something similar happened on an early Falcon 1 flight, resulting in unexpectedly high liquid oxygen residuals at main engine cutoff. So to summarize, we have a problem, or they have a problem, with having, they're ingesting gas, helium, which then makes the engines underperform, of course, could even destroy an engine, because you don't want to be sucking in an inert gas while you're trying to perform. It provided low thrust. So, yeah. So the quick fix was helium. As Casper says, they shouldn't have gone to helium. They should just fix the autogenous. The quick fix was using helium, because it's a lot safer. It won't phase change like that. They literally just change what's in the COPVs from gaseous methane or oxygen to helium. It's just an easy hardware and software switch based, not hardly hardware, but mostly software switch, and changing what bottles get filled with what. And they did that. And now they're sucking in. They're sucking in helium. So yeah. Here we are. And so now they just need to fix the slosh. So don't do that. Now they just need to fix the slosh problems, which is a solvable solution. Yeah.
I feel like this is the, when you go to the doctor thing, it's like, hey, when we do this with our rocket, it blows up. And they're like, oh, well, just don't do that then. How about that?
I kind of think it is exactly that. So I'm hoping that it's not the type of thing where you go to the doctor and you're like, see, it always hurts. And like my heart's, or, you know, or you go to the mechanic, like my brakes always squeak. And then you go there and they stop squeaking. And you're like, no, I swear they always do.
Yeah.
You know, they're trying to solve this.
That's how it always works.
Basically, yes. So moral of the story is we're going to see them make some hardware changes to the slosh tanks inside the header tanks. Now, again, for a reminder, there are two header tanks in this vehicle. There's the oxygen header tank in the nose, and there's the methane header tank in the middle of the vehicle in between the two main tanks. And these header tanks are literally purpose-built just mostly, you know, for the belly flop and the landing maneuver. They're, for all intents and purposes, basically full. They're basically full so that when you do that flip maneuver, you're not ingesting any air bubbles. That's exactly their intention. That's their purpose. So, so hopefully they solve the slosh problems.
So if I'm getting this
Trevor
right,
Trevor says they are not full, but they're more full than the other ones. Yeah.
If I'm understanding this right, they were going with the autogenous, having troubles with that. So they switched to the helium. And now realize that was a bad solution. So now they're going back to the autogenous.
Correct. But the helium was a quick fix anyway.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So perhaps, you know, so hopefully it wasn't the biggest deal in the world anyway. So, the quick fix was helium. They've wanted and intended to use, they wanted and intended to use autogenous this whole time, but now it looks like they probably just need to anyway. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, that's where we're at.
Well, so normally we do why don't they just way later, but we have two why don't they just that are exactly on that topic.
Cool.
Should
yeah,
we
let's
save
do
it for later or should we just jump right into that?
Let's do
why
it.
Why don't they just?
Okay. Y'all are on board with me. Sounds
yeah,
good.
Baby.
All right. Let old man Joe take about 15 minutes to pull up his thing now. Okay. So
we're gonna take
this
that
one's
out of context,
from
by the way.
Yeah. that could have sounded anyway. This is from Mr. Blue Jam.
And yeah, perfect.
Bob Murray also asked pretty much the same question. Basically, why don't they use a cylindrical header tank with a hydraulic ram and piston dealy? I think that's a technical term. I know it's more parts, but wouldn't it be more reliable than the whole autogenous pressurization approach? And Bob Murray said basically the same thing. Why don't they just make a methane header tank for Starship as a big cylinder and put a piston or membrane in there and push it with gas like a big syringe? And he just tweeted the same thing with lots of language.
Wasn't that, we talked about this, right? The syringe idea.
We've kind of talked about it in the roundabout way a little bit, but directly we have, I don't know if we really have for sure, but I guess Discord's saying we probably have. Yeah. So,
then I don't remember it.
I think we didn't necessarily talk about it. I think for header tank specifically, I think we just mentioned it as like a concept of, you know, why do they need like helium or any other back pressure solution?
Because in the syringe idea, if I remember, you know, I brought all my insights to this conversation, you know, so you guys are blessed with that. That a syringe itself still has to have something to backfill it, like on the backside of wherever the liquid's being pumped out of. And on Earth, when we do that, or on the ground when we do that, there's air, right, that does that naturally. Like, they're not perfectly sealed. So,
depends.
And usually the backside of it, like the ones we have for our kids for like their medicines and stuff, it has like, it's not perfectly sealed on the backside of it. So when you push the syringe down, the backside is open to, you know, the air in the room. Yep. Yeah. So, but in this situation that you would, so if I remember the summation was you would still have to put something in there because you're not just going to have it open. And obviously that wouldn't work in space, right?
Yep. Yep. Yeah, because you would have a pressure differential no matter
what.
You still
have the same problem. Yeah, it would like crush it.
Yeah, it would either crush it, or if you open it up, now it's crushing the thing that it's open to, or it's now exposed to space. So, yeah. Yep.
And I assume just on a base level, more parts are more parts bad. More moving parts, even worse.
Can someone tell Lego this? Because really, it's just way too much.
Have you ever stepped on a header tank? It's bad.
Yeah, basically, the moral of the story is it would definitely be a lot heavier and bigger, and all you're doing is you're putting, well, on the topic of, let's start with the topic of the membrane, because people keep mentioning a membrane. Good luck finding a cryogenic membrane, like a membrane that would be fluid enough to move perfectly in those environments that can also handle cryogenic temperatures, you know, and not have, and all you're trying to do is create a barrier. You're trying to make it so you don't ingest air bubbles, but you still do have to have the back pressure to fill it, to squeeze it and do all these things. But then with the piston, yeah, it's just big, heavy, extra parts to just simply separate out, preventing the gas from meeting the liquid, or for the liquid, for the engines ingesting any of the gas. And by the way, for the, I feel like Americans sometimes think gas as like a liquid because we use the term gasoline, you know, but when we're in general, when we say gas, we're meaning gaseous, like a state of matter, not gasoline. So we're talking about it as a phase, you know, it's going from liquid to gas. So gas and not necessarily fuel.
More excited molecules.
So we should just say petrol. Molecules. Liters of petrol.
But yeah, in this case, we're referring to gas, like the gaseousness of it. So yeah, it just isn't worth it. It's, you know,
as,
you probably could
as
do
Trevor
that,
said but... in Discord, mirroring Elon Musk, the best part is no part. Yeah. Is there an example of another part that might be getting rid of on the Starship?
Like a best part is no part thing?
Yeah.
No. Not really. Unless
right,
you like
topic.
Landing legs. Yeah. No, unless you like landing legs, because we've talked about on the show, of course, how SpaceX has this wild plan that they might be trying to pursue, where they're trying to maybe catch the booster of Starship and not need to put landing legs on booster. We talked about that when it happened, you know, when Elon was talking about it in, I don't remember, whoever, 40 years ago, and now I don't remember when it was, or yesterday, who knows, time is irrelevant. But now all of a sudden, Toby Lee asked on Twitter, has SpaceX team concluded with a better landing leg? Because obviously a lot of people are concerned about the landing legs, as we saw the dangly, horrendously inefficient landing, you know, insufficient
broken
landing
legs
on SN10. Yeah, obviously we've talked about before how those are temporary. So that is a big question. That's a pushing question. So Elon said, might just catch the ship with the launch tower, same as the booster.
Yeah.
Ah.
I think it's just to catch it in the ocean. You
Sorry?
Know? You catch it in the ocean.
Splash down?
It's big. Yeah, it's there. I mean, it's, you know.
Well, you'd have
you
to have,
have
a
to
very,
do anything.
You'd have to have a very low terminal velocity, though, for that to be survivable.
Well, so you could just put it back together if it breaks apart. Who cares?
Yeah, that kind of prevents the rapid reusability aspect. So I asked, I responded to this because I said Starship's belly flop terminal velocity is already only around like 75 meters per second. That's pretty darn slow. That's like, you know, 200 miles an hour or something, or 320 meters per kilometers an hour.
Kilometers.
So what if we remove the 30 tons of landing prop, so that'll lighten it up quite a bit, by maybe like 30%. Add some, maybe go back to, you know, take that 30%, make bigger flaps so you can have an even slower terminal velocity. Get that down to maybe 50 meters per second or even lower. You know, if you reduce your weight by 20 or 30% and increase your aerosurface, you might be able to get substantially slower. And then catch it with the world's largest and most ridiculous net. Like
did
in
you
the
just,
grand
why
scheme
don't they
of things.
Adjust Elon?
Yeah, I absolutely did. I absolutely did. And he responded, yeah, we talked about that internally. Could just have it land on a big net or bouncy castle. He said nice. It lacks dignity, but would work. But optimized landing propellant is only about 5% of dry mass, so it's not a game changer. So, yeah. They thought about it. And I liked my idea after this. I said, would it lack dignity if the bouncy castle was shaped like Pickle Rick and it just proclaimed I'm Pickle Rick each time it landed? Personally think it might just be worth it in that case. Or a Dogecoin like bouncy castle if it just landed in the middle of this giant pillow of Dogecoin. I mean,
I would watch that.
I think that would not lack any dignity. But yeah, this
are we
is...
in it for dignity or Mars? I mean, come on, what's, come on, what's
right? But that's what, okay, so there's a few things that this brings up, of course. Number one, everyone's screaming, there's no bouncy castle on Mars. You know, there's no bouncy castle on the moon. There's no tower on Mars to catch it. There's no tower on the moon.
Yet.
Well, come on. Of course, yet.
But something but people seem to forget to put it there.
But people seem to forget that there will be different versions of Starship. There will be variants. There will be cargo variants, tanker variants, lunar variants, maybe a deep space variant, maybe a point-to-point variant. Starship is a whole potential system. So if they are trying to maximize their mass efficiency and performance here on Earth for, say, tankers or cargoes that only are in Earth orbit and then land, you know, they go up into orbit and they land, go up into orbit, land. It's totally viable here if it works. You know, like, if they could get it to work, the ones that stay here, who needs legs?
You know, I still don't understand why this. Yeah, it seems like designing a leg would be easier. Like designing legs at work would be way easier than all those other.
I'm sure it would be. But it is, you know, you add performance because anytime you know, if they have to add 20, you know, tons of landing legs and landing structure and landing, you know, what it's fastened onto, that takes 20 tons away from their capability.
Capacity, their
payload capability. Now, granted, they have 100-ton capability to orbit, so maybe it'd be worth sacrificing some of that to be able to, you know, land. But, it is, you know, it is a solution. I mean, yes, it's insane. It's insane to consider this. But so is, like, you know, I drive by the port of Brownsville and I see how big oil tankers are and how big the oil rigs are. Those are insane. Like, they're cities that float on the water. Like, they're massive infrastructure, massive feats of engineering. Yet, like,
designed exactly to fit in the Panama Canal, as Joe Scott taught me on a video one day.
Panamax.
Like, the size of those tankers is for a reason. Yeah, because you could make them kind of infinitely large, right? Like, the ocean can handle anything you can put in it, but yeah.
Yep. Yeah. Yep. Designed around the Panama. Yeah, and so when you think about it, you know, we're sitting here going like, oh, that's so ridiculous. But like, is it in the grand scheme of what's physically possible? And if there's enough money, like, is it really that absurd to try to catch a rocket? I mean,
yes, it is still. But if they can do it, good job.
Well, so
it'll always be absurd.
Catching it in the same way that they're trying to catch the booster, it doesn't have the
grid
the
fins.
Grid fins. So what would they catch it with?
Well, so if their plan is to catch the booster using the grid fins, you know, and they say they just have like two cables run or something and they just hope that they catch it, those grid fins get stuck on it. You know, you could also do that with the top flaps, with the top flaps, or, you know, if it's a cable system or something like that, you could even do it horizontally potentially.
How about you catch it with Falcon Heavies?
Or catch it with the booster.
Four Falcon Heavies carrying a net up and then
yes.
There
you go.
But
you go.
But the biggest point of all this is, if, you know, people obviously were pretty like, oh, you can't catch the booster, that's ridiculous, because again, this all is ridiculous. But between catching Starship and catching the booster, Starship actually makes more sense. Starship is smaller, lighter. Yeah. It has more performance, like, or it takes a bigger performance hit if you have landing legs on it. Because the booster, if you have landing legs, say you have 20 tons of landing infrastructure for the booster, that'll take about a 5 kilogram hit to orbit, or 5 ton hit to orbit. It's about a quarter, as opposed to Starship is 1-to-1. For every single kilogram you add to the weight of the dry mass of the vehicle, you take away a kilogram of payload. So it actually makes more sense to do that.
So. Yeah, I'm can't wait to see what that's going to look like. I just still can't even picture it, but that's why there's smart people there.
I still want to see
it
land.
Fun stuff, though. Yeah.
You did see
so
it.
So
land.
I mean, this is definitely the long, yeah, we did kind of. This is definitely the long-term goal, you know, of SpaceX and Starship. And I'm not going to put anything off the table. When they say they're going to do something ridiculous, it's why not? If it makes sense, sure. If it makes sense financially and operations-wise in the long run, sure. But for a while, obviously, we still expect to see upgraded landing legs at some point. So, yeah.
Any idea when SN11 might?
They're trying. They're going. They're already like trying to cryoproof it basically any day now. And as soon as they cryoproof it, I think they're just going to try and static fire it right away, and then try and fly it right away. So there's a small chance we might see it. If we see it static Friday, there's a chance we might see it fly next, like early next week already.
So, is there going to be a gap? Because I haven't. I mean, is SN15 still like coming along, or
SN15 is the next one right now? Yep. So they are doing that gap between.
Yeah. Sorry.
Yeah. So 12, 13, 14 still totally scrapped. Yeah. 15 is the one currently being worked on, and it will be the next one. And it's supposedly has some decent upgrades.
I was just wondering if it's far enough along that it would be launched in a relatively quick succession, or if they still got a ways to go on it.
Or is it going to be 2 months or something?
Yeah.
It's not. It needs more work. Like, say, pretend they did launch Tuesday or something, right? SN11 launches Tuesday. SN15 still appears to have several weeks worth of work, so there will be more of a substantial gap. But yeah, they and as Trevor points out, they likely might test the booster even, BN1 or BN2, one of the boosters, or both, or
how far along are those? Do we have any shots of those yet?
Yeah, they're stacking them in the background. They're going to be 70 meters tall.
Versus how big is Starship?
The Starship is 50 meters tall.
Oh, nice.
Okay.
So decent amount taller here.
Yeah, but it's not like twice as big or,
this is from
three times as
Brendan Lewis on Twitter, has these awesome, awesome graphics here. So this kind of shows the size here. This is where they're at right now. Booster number one. Is basically the top tank is almost done. The bottom tank is with the the in between, the common dome is being worked on, and the downcomer, and they're stacking those rings as we speak, basically, or getting ready to.
Why is SN16 so big? That's interesting. Why is SN16?
It's spread out because it's not actually stacked. They're showing Yeah.
Got you. So those aren't. Yep. Okay. That makes sense.
Those rings are not completed yet. So, and the blue part shows like what is a recent addition. So they have parts already out there for 18. 16, 17 are being worked on. But yeah, right now, currently, as of the recording of this video, on Thursday, the 11th or whatever, March 11th, SN2, the cryogenic test article is still out of the pad waiting to pop or do whatever, waiting to take its turn getting blown up or whatever their plan is. SN10 this is already old because SN10 is obviously bye-bye.
Yeah.
SN11, this was February 20th. There's got to be a newer one than this. I just realized let's find his.
Yeah, I just noticed that too.
But that makes sense in terms of the size of it all. Yeah. Yeah, I don't know why I had in my head that it was going to be 2 to 3X the size of Starship, which was like insane how big that would be, right?
This is March 5th. Here we go. Oh, these are the decommissioned ones. That's funny.
Way to go.
Let's see. As of March 5th, these are the current. Here we go. Here's the current prototypes.
Got it.
So here we go. So SN10. Yep. 15 is in the mid bay. 16 is getting close. But yeah, high bay right now, they are stacking the top section or the bottom section of it as we speak in the high bay.
Is there any parts that come from California here, or like the Raptors and stuff, or something like the header tank, COPVs, any of that stuff?
Yeah. A decent amount of stuff still comes in from California. I think the fins even are manufactured in California. The Raptors are obviously manufactured in California. Then there's some hardware that's just, probably little bits like valves or certain things that are like more intricate machined parts. It's more like the final assembly and the stacking is done here, basically. It's kind of how you can think of
it. Yeah, and probably they already are making a lot of these bits in California for Falcon 9s and stuff, right? The flanges or whatever type of little things. Yeah, so it makes sense just to be like, okay, ship those out. And people aren't shooting them as they go through Texas, huh? Must be because it was so cold.
I don't know. Can't even 0 degree temperatures might they'll shoot the cold. That's how they get. That's how you warm up around
climate change. Where's it at?
Yeah.
Oh, so that kind of gets us caught up with SpaceX. Are there any other, you know, are there any other competitors to SpaceX or anything, or any of Elon's other companies that we need to be paying attention to? I heard something about a Tesla killer.
Yeah, I mean, speaking
what's
of...
What's killing Tesla today?
Speaking of ridiculous ideas, Canoe, and I was, you know, Kazuntite. No, it's the name of the company, Canoe. It's, they unveiled a fully electric pickup truck. And I say that questioning. I don't know. Can you call this a truck? Okay. So rewind. Canoe makes this little pod thing. It's an all electric thing. It was guys that left from Faraday Future. If you remember them, I think Faraday Future is still around. Chances are they're going to like go public for $800 billion tomorrow or something. But Faraday Future, you know, they were doing some stuff a while ago. And then they left and started this company called Canoe that made this cutesy little pod thing. And it was like a people mover, you know, at an airport, fully autonomous, fully electric, very Westworld looking, if you're familiar with Westworld. Well, now they've unveiled an EV or an electric pickup truck, you know, dubbed the Canoe pickup truck. You know, interesting name there. And it has the same cutesy little bubbly front. But the back is a pickup truck that kind of transforms. It's really bananas. Like
it's more than meets the eye.
It's this really thing Canoe. Is,
yay. Good.
Thank you. Thank you.
Show me the back of this, how it's modular and folds out. Like scroll down a bit, Tim. There's some photos here that people need to see.
Well, this one has it, right?
That's cool. But no. Go down even further. There's like these overhead shots. Yeah, these ones. So it's pretty small in terms of its size, and it has like a standard, like a shorter bed. But then the tailgate, which normally, you know, flips down, here like flips down and out as well to extend the bed to be quite a bit bigger. And inside of the bed, there are all these dividers, so you can have, you know, things not moving around back there. That seems kind of like a trivial thing. This stuff already exists for trucks. But yeah, the sides will fold down. In the front, you have like this little operating table. I don't know what to call it in the front of it. That folds down as sort of like a table as well with like a little lighted compartment, like a frunk. But the frunk isn't you put stuff down in. It's like you put it like a shelf.
It's like a horizontal frunk.
Yeah, exactly. It's like a frunk on its side. And then it's going to have like this actually could be your next car, Tim. Scroll down a bit more. You can see the camping version of this / SUV version of it. Yeah. And so all kinds of weird doors here, all kinds of weird stuff. It has outlets for you to plug stuff into, you know, this kind of cargo camping thing on top. And the interior is also pretty bananas. The whole thing is actually just really cool. I actually really, really dig it. It looks ridiculous, but not more ridiculous than the Cybertruck, I have to say.
I think the thing on the back with the tailgate that comes down and the doors that it's almost like it extends out the cab or something.
Yeah. Yeah. It's pretty wild.
Or not the cab that extends out the bed.
Oh, the bed. Sorry. Yeah.
Yeah. The bed.
Yeah. Yep.
And it goes 200 plus miles on a single charge. That's seems like the limitation here. 600 horsepower, 550 pound feet of torque, and can tow about 1,800 pounds. So, or was that like 800 kilograms, something like that?
Yeah, well, I like the LEDs around the bed. That's cool too.
Yeah,
yeah. No, it's. I think from a design standpoint, Cybertruck led the way, and for this to even be allowed, and for people not just to vomit when they see it. which was my reaction to Cybertruck. But the interior, I mean, a lot of it, I think it's really innovative and cool. I don't know. What do you guys think? I don't think we have a price yet. This was like leaked pre-posting, I think. So they have an unveiling coming soon, but this was like sort of leaked in advance. Mm.
They leaked a lot.
Well, I think it was one of those things where like, I think it was one of those things where like it leaked and then they were like, okay, screw it. Here you go.
That's one leaky Canoe.
Oh,
where is the butt? Thank you. Jeez, that was the best.
I knew you were gonna do that.
Well, I'll give my thoughts while Joe takes his round of applause.
My victory lap.
I personally actually love this. I think it's surprisingly cool and quirky, and I just love like utilitarian design like this, where everything has a little, you know, place and a little, they can kind of be modular and you can move things around. I think it's cool. I think there is a huge demand for a lighter truck market, personally. I think the United States has just inflated our trucks to the size of just pure ridiculousness, when 99% of the time we don't need half of it. Not even half of it. Like 99% of the time we don't need 80% of it, you know? So I think this is great. I don't know how well this would handle like the US market. I just think we have this ego about bigger, better, stronger, faster. 1800 pounds of towing ain't nothing. You know, how am I going to tow my, which is a use case for a lot of, for some people.
How am I going to tow a Starship? Come on.
Right.
I just don't see truck nuts hanging off the back of that thing.
maybe like on the front, right in front of it, in front of the windshield. Kind of carrot and stick there.
What's the anatomy there? I don't understand.
Yeah. But I kind of like it. I think it's cool. What do you think, Joe?
This is the first time I've seen it. And it makes me want to go look further into it. And Ben, I think you make a really good point that like, if it wasn't for Cybertruck, everybody would look at that and be like, what is this? But because like the scope of what a truck can be, I guess, has been so blown out by the stainless steel coffin that like something like that almost looks normal or normal-ish, you know? I still don't see anybody from my hometown in Texas driving that, because they want their Chevys and they want their F-150s, and that's a status symbol. And you know, it's I could see them maybe going for a Rivian, maybe. Like, there's a part of me that would love to get my hands on a Rivian and drive over there and just see what kind of response it gets. Even though they probably wouldn't like the headlights, but anyway, I think it's cool. I mean, looking at all the different, you know, features on it, I think they've got some really cool stuff on there.
Yeah. Sorry. One more time. Discord kind of wanted to browse through it here. It's cool. I'm with you though, about the kind of the status quo. And I even wonder too, with, you know, when you mentioned Rivian, I feel like that's going to be kind of it's going to end up being like the Oregon and Seattle, you know, or like the Washington people, the Oregon, like outdoor hippies that love Rivian, you know, or in Northern California type of woodsy individuals, and not, I still don't think they're going to hit that, you know, kind of the more, yeah, exactly, Ben. I still don't think they're going to hit like the middle of the US, kind of the conservative group. I just don't think it's still that bread and butter type of truck. But here's
the
my
price
theory.
Too. The price matters too.
Electric F-150 is coming. That'll be the winner for sure. You know, one's going to change a family that's been driving Ford trucks for 40 years to any other brand. Just doesn't matter. Just won't happen.
I keep saying, like, anybody that has a sticker on the back of their truck of Calvin pissing on a Chevy logo is not going to buy a Rivian.
Yeah.
Or a Tesla. Nor
a Tesla or anything else. Yeah. It doesn't matter. Yeah, 100%.
But I do actually think if you're not a loyalist and you are, I still think once Cybertruck truly hits the market, I think there's going to be a lot of like contractors and stuff that just simply see it as, this will actually save me money. And look at all the cool stuff it can do that our other trucks can't.
I really do think you're right. I think contractors, maybe not even in rural areas, but like urban areas, like they might get the functionality out of it and the cost savings over time that make it worth it. And somebody pointed out one time that like it would be a great advertising vehicle, like people wrapping their trucks with their logos and stuff. Like if you really want to get everyone's attention,
I can already see the Red Bull thing now with like the actual Red Bull can and like the girls and the things driving around handing them out. Like I can already see it.
Hot tub in the back.
Bang Energy, all these other ones. I see them all over now, and they have like a Kia Soul or something dumb. Like guaranteed. If your mission is to get attention, yes. Exactly. That's the truck. That's the car. It's the Hummer. It's the
new Hummer. Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. The contractors that want people to see their logo everywhere they go.
Exactly.
I could totally see it for that.
Yeah. Yeah, and coincidentally, it's badass and has like incredible specs and is cheap. Right. Like it actually is incredible at what it can do. But I think the biggest feature of the Cybertruck is the attention gettingness of it. You know? Yeah.
Exactly.
Yep. Yeah. For sure.
Yeah, that'll be exciting.
Yeah.
Well, there's one other thing that a quick hit for you here, and maybe another Tesla killer on the horizon. Toyota, the Japanese company that sells a few cars.
Heard of them?
Toyota. You know, they actually changed the spelling of the name to make it shorter, so that would be more efficient, and they would have to save money on like ink and stuff. Isn't that crazy? Like it originally was like T-O-Y-O-D-A, but the T. Now, obviously, in English, it doesn't matter, but in the Japanese characters, anyways, long story short, these guys are obsessed with efficiency. So they have something coming out called an X Prologue. So, you know, it's a copy of the Model X, apparently. I don't know. and so they're getting...
preceded the Model X, apparently. Prologue.
Oh, right. Yeah. What am I thinking? What's the an encore? What's after the book?
Postlude.
Post-Malone.
So we don't really know much about it right now. We have this little teaser image, and we have an unveiling date. The confusing, weird part about this. So in 5 days, as of this recording, is when we'll get to know more about this. But the weird thing. So that's a Wednesday, the 17th of March, for anyone following along. But the weird thing is, like, Toyota is a sort of an enigma when it comes to. Electric vehicles. They've had the Mirai, I don't know, for a while, and that thing is not cool. I don't know how to describe it. Like, it's a hydrogen fuel cell car that only lasts for a couple years because of the, you know, hydrogen destroys the welds and things. It just isn't possible to really, like, handle it very well. And it's costs you an insane, ungodly amount of money to fuel it. So they give you free fuel. And there's like 15, or no, I'm sorry. There's, if the last time I checked, in the United States, the entire United States, these United States, 47 or 49 hydrogen fueling stations, and like 90% of them are in California for this one car specifically to help with the compliance of the zero emission vehicle mandate from California. I mean, Toyota's had a really weird kind of choppy history with this whole thing, despite them being one of the early ones with like the Prius and stuff. They really haven't. And in fact, the on the electric article here, they talked about it. The CEO, there you go. See, Akio Toyoda with a D. See, they spell it, anyways. He went on a rant about battery electric vehicles and how it's just bad. It's real. I don't know what the hell they're doing. But maybe if they really cared, they could make a really compelling electric vehicle. And I've been saying it forever. Like, when I first got the Model 3, my first thought was, damn, Honda needs to make this without 90% of this stuff. Like, without all these bells and whistles, if you got rid of all that and you could make this a $18,000 or $22,000 car, this thing would sell like amazing, just because the cost of fuel, the ease of refueling it at your house, low maintenance, and the torque and all the things that electric motors give you. Like, if you just made a regular Honda Civic but electric that was badass like that, dude, that thing would sell like crazy. So maybe that's what they're doing here. Maybe that's just me projecting. I hope that Toyota gets in the game. Otherwise, honestly, in 10 years, I don't know if we'll remember who Toyota was. It'll be like MG or one of those brands. It's like, you know, these old brands that like aren't around anymore. And you're like, oh yeah, there was that company. Maybe I really think that's where Toyota's headed if they don't get it together and make something compelling.
Yeah.
So what do you guys think?
What do you think, Joe?
Are they going to do it or not?
I'm curious to see what this car turns out to be. I mean, we don't have any specs or anything on it, right? It's just like a little teaser image right now.
A teaser image and sort of an announcement that in 5 days it's coming out.
But it is battery electric.
I believe so. Yes.
Yeah. At least
fully electric.
Finally, you know, at least that's a step in that. Well, I say it's a step in the right direction. Hydrogen advocates would probably disagree with me, but their hangout on hydrogen has been disappointing. Yeah.
The CEO of Shell wouldn't agree with you. Yeah, I don't think so.
Right. Yeah.
For myself, I just don't understand if you are the CEO or, you know, the board of directors for an automotive company and you see trends and you literally just go, oh, look, these are doing well and these are declining. Like, which one would you hop on? Like, why did it take this long to see that the writing on the wall that that electric vehicles, there's a demand for them. And especially even, I think consumers are starting to get ready or used to the idea of a use case for them. That a lot of people with their two-car home, they realize that they can have a relatively short range EV. And if they need to go on big road trips or something, and they can keep the other, you know, internal combustion engine for, you know, as a transition for now, or just because they prefer it anyway. Like, I think the market's finally realizing that an EV for day-to-day use is substantially more convenient and just generally better. So I'm just confused why have they been so stubborn of anti-EV, you know, like entirely EV?
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense to me at all, considering how early they were with some of the other stuff. Speaking of that, Tim, there is something here that's kind of funny. I don't know if you want to bring it up. It's called Electromechanica Solo. Have you heard of this? Go Google that right now. But it kind of gets to your point of this concept of, or there's other companies too. Like I think Arcimoto is one, although that's like a motorcycle thing. Mm-hmm. I don't know. This concept of like you have a really small, really efficient, really cheap commuter car that isn't anything. And then you have your other car, you know, for the bigger things, right? For hauling the kids around. This, what you're seeing here, is a three-wheeled vehicle. It technically is a motorcycle. It goes 100 miles on a charge. It is ridiculous with the amount of like lack of room and everything it has. But I saw it in person at the mall. And I was blown away. I was like, what? I remember walking by it like, what the hell is this? I've never heard of this. But yeah, that little trunk thing is all they get. That little tiny, like you can fit a backpack in the back. That's about it.
Yeah.
That's all the storage there is. There's nothing in the front. There's no undercarriage. There's no nothing. But the idea was, does it say the price on there? I think the idea was like it's dirt
18,
cheap.
$18,500 right there.
Yeah, $18,500 minus about $10,000. Right, because you've got $7,500 federal rebate, right. California $1,500 clean air rebate. So you're looking at like a $10,000 car almost, and that's awesome. Now the interior is, I think I called it like retro cool. It literally is like they just bought leftover parts from a Honda Accord in the 1980s. It is such old junk, but who cares? Who cares? Like if people are willing to do this, I applaud them for that. So.
I mean, think about the savings you get getting a $10,000 EV with not having to pay for gas on top of that.
Yeah.
Well they someone have that calculator right here.
Yeah, someone did that recently. They looked at the cheapest cars, electric cars to lease or something like that, or maybe it wasn't even electric. And I think it was a Chevy Bolt came out to like $100 a month or something like that. You know, and then add in fuel and everything else, and you're like $150 a month. It just happened, and the Chevy Bolt is like a very legit, capable vehicle, right? Over 200 miles of range, good size storage, seating for four or five ish people. Like it's a very, you know, this thing is like kind of laughably small and whatever. A Chevy Bolt's like a legit car, a legit. So, and $100 a month. I mean, that's amazing. Like, I would totally do that.
Sometimes I feel like we talk too much about, I mean, not we, but in general, the EV community talks way too much about like Tesla and doesn't talk about things like that, that are just maybe a little niche, but also really interesting solutions, you know?
Mm-hmm. At Fully Charged Live. Option. Yeah. At Fully Charged Live, when we were all there, there was a panel I sat on and we were talking about that. And Chelsea Sexton was up there and she asked everyone in the audience to raise their hand if they have an electric car that is not a Tesla. 70% of the people's hands went up.
In the audience.
The vast majority of the people in the audience had electric cars that were not Teslas.
Yeah.
And it was really cool to see because I think at that level, you are a real enthusiast, right? Like it's super easy to want a Tesla. Like there are so many things to want about it and you could give a crap about the planet or anything. Like it's just, it's the fastest, best thing out there. But to have a Chevy Bolt, yeah, like you're choosing that for a reason, you know what I mean? And you're definitely not in it for the sex appeal or whatever else. Right, so yeah. I really applaud that. And I mean, personally on my channel, I've been really shifting my content towards non-Tesla stuff, because I feel like that is what we need to talk about more, because that's really what will move the needle forward. You know, it's like the iPhone in the smartphone world. You know, Apple has 15% market share, but it feels like they have 90% market share in our heads of smartphones. But 85% of smartphone users in the world are non-iPhone users. So you have to think about it. Like, I think EVs could very well go that same route, where Tesla is always the premium luxury version and dominates the media attention. But 80% of EVs in the world are not Tesla, you know, sold by Tesla. So, which is fine, because I think you need everything. You need the cheap $10,000 one, and you need the badass $250,000 Porsche, whatever.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. When I had my Vespa, which is obviously not electric or anything, but like, I don't know, these little cars, like the one you just showed, makes me think of that a little bit. Like, you know, I wasn't going to be taking any road trips with it or anything, but to just get around town and to, you know, go to a restaurant, like, this wouldn't apply to this. I'm just kind of like giving my experience, but like, we used to live near Greenville Avenue here in Dallas, which is like Restaurant Row. It's where all the cool bars and stuff are. And there's no parking. Like, you basically have to factor in a parking ticket or a towing charge into your night when you go down there. Like, it's just part of it. Or you have to valet or whatever. But I could go down there on my little Vespa and just park it on the sidewalk and walk right in. And I had bad hair, but who cares? You know, but there was like the little trunk underneath the seat, you know, so you could get a few things and put it in there if you had to just kind of take a little trip to the store. Like, I see things like that, and it's even more functional than that. You're out of the weather. It's got a little bit more space than underneath the seat, but it has a similar, I don't know. It brings back my memories of riding around in my Vespa, which was actually a lot of fun, you know, and very practical. Yeah.
I feel that way about electric bikes. Like, I just got an electric bike now, and after everyone and their mom telling me I need to get one, and me being like, I don't get it. Like, it's less carbon neutral than a regular bike. Like, I don't. Anyways, and now that I have one, I'm like, this thing is awesome. Like, yeah, I'm going down to the coffee shop or whatever. I don't need to drive. I can literally hop on this thing. It takes zero effort, or practically zero effort, to get there. And, you know, had there been a parking issue, absolutely. You know, yeah, I agree with you. Like, more forms of transportation that are easier in other ways, like parking, fantastic. We need all of it, you know?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
For sure. That's awesome.
Well, should we take a break?
Should we take it?
It feels like it's time for a break.
It's time for a break.
We'll be right back.
Hey, everybody. We wanted to take just a second to say thanks to all of the fans that watch this channel and give us feedback. And, you know, if it wasn't for that, not just for this thing, but for my channel, Answers with Joe, Everyday Astronaut, Teslanomics, if it wasn't for you guys, we wouldn't be able to do this at all. So thank you very much.
I mean, seriously, like, literally, if you guys weren't watching this, we wouldn't be doing this. So it's your feedback and your comments, your likes, your subscriptions. I mean, it all really matters. This community is what brings us together.
And one of the coolest parts is when you can join the conversation, such as the Why Don't They Just that gets submitted, and all the folks that join us each week to listen live via our Discord server. So we wanted to just let you know about how you can become a part of that and join via Patreon.
That's right. Patreon members get exclusive perks like early access to episodes. They get some behind the scenes things, meetup opportunities. But like Ben said, it's the people actually are listening to our recordings every week, and in our chat room live, they get their names in the credits and things like that. That's a really fun way to be able to interact with other people in the community and just especially hang out during this time when you might be looking for more things to do online anyway.
They also get to hear us say stuff that doesn't wind up making it on the air, stuff that's more naughty, you might say. But anyway, if you would like to join them and join this awesome community, we do appreciate it. You can go to olfpod.com, and we'll see you there.
And now, back to our ludicrous programming.
And we're back.
Hey,
that's one way to do it.
Yeah. Bang. We're here.
I think we might have another Why Don't They Just.
Why don't they just...
Ben was just so excited to be able to do that twice this week.
Yeah. He made his day.
We just need a whole episode of this. A whole episode of this. And
he's gonna sleep like a baby tonight.
Hi, Jake. Praise
Well, I mean, it's understandable. Jake's nervous that people are trying to destroy his house, so he's trying to do...
there's somebody at our front door that my wife is talking to, so I don't know what is... I live in a circus, guys. I might as well travel through my house on a friggin' trapeze right now.
I just assume Mark Cuban comes over for drinks every other week because you're
It's so annoying.
Yeah. Either him or
Mark
W.
Mark Cuban lives in Dallas? I always thought he like lived in Miami or something.
I'm sure he has houses.
He owns the Mavericks.
Yeah.
Oh, I don't know anything. I don't even know what that means.
Why don't they just today comes from Lupez 420. Says, why don't they just build a solar satellite network in Earth orbit for supporting cryptocurrencies and NFTs? Since we talked about this last week, I thought.
Oh, geez.
Well,
don't get me started on this, guys.
I mean, isn't something that Ben quite literally says like almost every week?
What?
So. Is the idea here that, and I'm only kind of interpreting this tweet, but kind of what we were talking about before about putting data centers up there?
Right.
Yeah. And the problem with that was heat, right?
Yep.
Yes.
Yeah. So is that the answer? Is that the why don't?
I mean, yeah. Computer centers in space are horrendous, would be horrendously expensive, and... The biggest problem is computers create a lot of heat, as we know, and people think space is cold, but it's not that space is cold, is that there's no air at all to have any thermal conductivity or conductivity at all. Mm-hmm. So it's if you have a bunch of heat somewhere and you need to get rid of it, you can't blow a fan across it or anything. It's really hard to radiate the heat away.
And to put it in perspective, I know everyone, and I think I want to do a video on this on my second channel, or maybe the main channel, who cares? Bitcoin or cryptocurrencies and things do take a lot of energy, but I don't think people understand the scale of it. And I'm saying that it's smaller than you probably think. So, for example, and there's a study by University of Cambridge, they have a thing called the Bitcoin Electricity Consumption Index. And we can put a link there, or I can send it over to you, Tim, if you want to share the screen. I'll just put it in Discord for people. So Bitcoin represents 0.5% of total electricity. 0.59% of total electricity consumption in the world. 0.59%. And then if you scroll down a little bit, you can see the how Bitcoin energy compares to renewables. And so the times here, so hydropower could power the entire Bitcoin network 33 times over. Biofuel and waste could power it 5 times over. And solar, wind, and others could power it 11 times over. So Bitcoin does take a lot of energy, for sure.
That's a lot more than I thought. I wouldn't think it'd be anywhere near a percent even.
Well, it's a half a percent, what? Yeah. But it's not like we can't do it. You know, I hear people say that like, oh, well, when Bitcoin, you know, gets more popular, the entire world's energy will, like the whole planet will go dark because we're trying to power Bitcoin or something. And it's like, that's not true at all. That is not even near true. It does take a lot of energy. Yes, I'm not trying to say that, but like, put it in perspective. And so there's also a thing about the study from Northwestern University that look at data centers. So getting more to the question about powering these things, and data centers in the entire planet take up about 1% of the world's energy. And those data centers power everything that you know, like watching and listening to this, every app on your phone, every computer in the world, everything. Everything, I mean, even things that you don't interact with, like things that run our infrastructure systems and all those kind of things, right? So data centers, 1% of the world's energy, Bitcoin taking about 0.5, 0.6% of the world's energy. It's not a problem that we can't solve, I guess is my point. And I hear a lot of people out there making it out to be like almost like the it reminds me of Joe, remember your video about what's the thing where you capture all the energy of the star and you're like, yeah, we would just have to like, you know,
Dyson sphere.
Yeah, we would just have to like destroy Mercury and capture every piece of rock from Mercury to make it. Like, I think that's how people at least talk about the energy needs of something like Bitcoin, but it's nowhere near that. It is not even close. So let's like Yes, it takes a lot of energy, but it is not a big problem, guys. We can handle it easily.
I do want to spit back at you what you just said, though. 1%-ish is everything, every data center in the world runs on 1% of our energy. Data centers is like everything. I mean, that's a lot. That's mainstream as it gets. That's every transaction for everything, every website, every phone app, everything is a data center.
Google, Facebook.
1%.
Yeah. Everything,
Google,
Apple,
Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, freaking YouTube. You're telling me that's
Bitcoin.
1%.
Bitcoin is also part of that.
In there. It's also making part of that. You're telling me that Bitcoin on its own, which is nowhere near mainstream at all, in the grand scheme of transactions and stuff. No. Nowhere near mainstream yet. Is 0.5%? Then I think that's a huge problem. If it gets 10 times more popular, 5% of our global energy, if it gets 100 times more popular,
yeah, I think
50% of our global energy consumption would be just to use Bitcoin.
Yeah, there's no way. That's what
horrendous.
I'm saying. It doesn't work that way. It's not linearly. You can't extrapolate it linearly like that, because the amount of power, the vast majority of the power being consumed for Bitcoin currently is from countries trying to get free Bitcoins by mining. Yeah. So it's not the amount of transactions, and Bitcoin itself is extremely limited on how many transactions it can process. That's why it'll never be a currency. And the answer to this, because there are a bazillion coins out there, and each coin runs on some sort of chain, some blockchain. The answer to all of this is Ethereum 2.0, or at least this is the hope from a lot of people. The reason this is so complicated and so tough is because you have a trustless system.
Trustless, yeah.
Right. So in a trustful system, say Visa or MasterCard or whatever, you go swipe your card. The vendor has a machine that goes to a third party and says, does Tim have enough money to buy 5 Starships? Okay, yes, he does. Cool, this transaction is approved. You have a person, a middleman that says, yes, that is the case. In the Bitcoin or blockchain world, you don't have that third party, the bank, if you call it that, is removed from the equation. So how can one party trust another party? Well, that's what blockchain does. It allows you to have a trustless system. I can never say trustless. Anyways. But the reason that it takes so much energy is because the way that these are made is on a thing called the way that they're validated is a system called proof of work. And that's where you have to have like the entire blockchain stored on every computer that's doing this, which means you need insane amounts of computers to run these things. But with the new Ethereum 2.0 thing, we're shifting away from proof of work to proof of stake. Now, if this works, and there's a big if there, but a lot of people seems to think it will. I can't talk. Sorry. Then the amount of computing power and all that, and coincidentally, the amount of transactions you can process are infinitesimally small compared to what they are now. So, will the future of cryptocurrency eat the world's energy? Not likely, because we'll solve it. There will be an answer. If the entire world had to run on Bitcoin as a currency, yeah, it would destroy us. And that's why it's not going to happen. So like, you're not totally wrong, but like, let's just have a sense of reality. Like, it's not going to happen, I guess is my point. It's right. Not that it couldn't be that, but it's definitely not going to.
Yeah.
So we'll be okay.
Joe, go ahead. What were you gonna say?
Well, not to derail. It's been a while since I've dug into Bitcoin as a topic, and it's not something I'm like really into. You know, I'm not invested in it or anything like that, so I don't claim any real special knowledge. But I know that there have been. I mean, Bitcoin was like the first cryptocurrency. It was like the first blockchain-based thing, and so it's the almost prototype version of it, you know, whereas they're like, you talk about Ethereum 2.0. I'm not as familiar with that one, but wasn't there one called Ripple or something like that?
Yeah. By Chase. Right.
I don't know if it had anything to do with Chase, but there was,
they created it.
Well, maybe it's not Ripple then, but there was
XRP, right?
There was something anyway, it's an improvement on it that doesn't, it's not so power intensive and whatnot. Mm-hmm. Anyway, my point being, like, it's just kind of funny that, like, Bitcoin has become, like, the standard for crypto.
Yeah.
When it was, like, the first and probably the jankiest. You know, and there's probably better systems that have come along since then. And I don't know
factually,
if Bitcoin...
Like,
what's that?
Factually speaking, there's definitely more efficient and better versions of it now, you know, like you're saying. Yeah.
Yeah. But, I mean, could Bitcoin convert to that? Better, more efficient system, or would it have to be some whole new coin kind of thing?
That's interesting. Yeah. So my limited understanding is you have the chain that is the blockchain network in which a coin exists on. So Bitcoin runs on like the Bitcoin blockchain network or whatever.
Right.
Could you run Bitcoin, the actual coin, on Ethereum 2.0, essentially? And I forget there's a name for it. I think they call it Beth. I forget what the B stands for. Ethereum or something.
Something access token, I think.
Yeah. Anyways, but yeah, clearly there are other ones. And I think the big shift was, and maybe this is the thing that most people, if they know anything about Bitcoin, don't get, is that it's not meant to be a currency anymore. It's a like gold, essentially. It's an investment vehicle. So you buy it, you hold it, maybe you sell it here and there, but it's not like I'm going to buy a pizza for it, which is like why, is it Tesla that's actually going to accept Bitcoin for cars? Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking about it like
that,
like that seems bizarre to me that first off, anyone would want to do that. But second off, that they would want to, because there's definitely a delay when you put in an order, right? It's not like an instantaneous transaction like your Visa card. So in that time, the price of it could fluctuate a lot. Like it's not set up as a currency, really, you know? Although maybe that was the original idea. I don't know. But yeah, NFTs, for people wondering, as far as I understand, run on the Ethereum chain. So they should move over to Ethereum 2.0, which I think is still 2 to 3 years away. But if so, if we get Ethereum 2.0, that'll be the way everything works, essentially, because it is with lower energy demands, it's cheaper to run it, and you can have a gazillion times more transactions. I think it's like 100,000 transactions per second. And one thing that's interesting too to think about is our current currency, our fiat currency that we have, isn't carbon free either, right? It still takes a lot of emissions and a lot of energy to cut down trees and to print money, as well as to store the trillions of digits in banks and on those data centers already. So there is some cost that currency of any form will have.
And processing all those transactions costs energy too.
So there is no way to get around it. What was the question?
Well, they were talking about a Starlink type system up in space to manage the NFTs and everything.
Because heat.
Yeah.
There's the answer.
Got away from that a while back.
And the expense of launching something, payload to orbit is still stupidly cost prohibitive. We're talking like $20,000, $30,000 a kilogram. Like, it's a lot easier and cheaper to just do it here.
How often, or do we know when Starlink will actually be a profitable company? The reason I'm thinking that is because it costs so much to launch a satellite.
Well, they have, you can total it up. They're at about, we'll say 20 satellites or 20 launches now, and we'll say it internally costs them $25 million. So they're at $500 million, half a billion, let's say, just rough numbers. Let's pretend that those satellites also cost them a half billion. So they're at a billion now. I don't know. I have no idea. Somewhere between 1 billion and 1.5 billion or something. How long will it take them to recoup that? How many customers at $100 a month and a $500,
Yeah. But that's not bad, not considering bad. What you're getting. I wonder, do we know how the actual capacity of the network? Like, is there a finite number of people that can connect? I'm sure it's massive,
more just there's a total amount of bandwidth currently available, and that's based on satellites. And the more satellites that go out, the more bandwidth that's available, and the more, I'm sure there is a limit to how many devices each satellite can link to, but I'm sure that's quite high, and we're probably not near that saturation quite yet. But I'm sure that we're just limiting the amount of bandwidth totally. And that's increasing every single launch. So that's great.
I'm still just so, that's like probably one of the companies I'm most excited about is Starlink.
Yeah. Yeah. It's insane.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, Joe,
speaking of traveling to stars.
Yes. Ooh. I do have to apologize. You guys are frozen to me. I know it's on my end here, but I can't see anything. So hopefully I'm not missing any pretty pictures.
you're pretty laggy from where
we're
sitting.
Yeah, it's on my end. I don't know what's going on. It's just the week of troubles.
Well, you got but a new studio. You're still working out some kinks. We can put it up to that.
You need like a T1 line down there. Is that still a thing?
Hey, you're not going to get that nice municipal internet here in Texas.
Trust me. I know.
Is the internet grid also separated from the rest of the internet in Texas?
Probably.
Like the internet's down in all of Texas.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, God. Don't trigger me.
Well, just real quick. A paper came out in the recent days of your what? Okay. Anyway, on warp drive, on faster than light travel. So a little bit of background for those who might not be quite up on it. So as we all know, we can't travel faster than the speed of light. If you want to move any kind of mass at the speed of light, you need an infinite amount of energy, which is hard to get. So the idea of a warp drive is that instead of traveling through space-time, trying to, you know, pass the speed of light or approach the speed of light, is you just warp space-time itself. So you like contract the space in front of you and expand the space behind you. So you always see images like this. Let me see if I can find it. Woo!
It's like a bent piece of paper, right?
We went plaid. You always see photos like this.
Those are ads, by the way.
Yeah, I know. So sorry, but like I found this on my phone and it has this like phone layout to
it. Oh, the AMP version.
The AMP version, which I tried to undo that and then it like tried to make it.
Accelerated mobile page.
So horrible. Sorry about that.
Google's ruining everything, I know.
So this is a sort of a chart of what warp drive looks like or what it's doing. So in the front, so like right here in the middle, in the little yellow part, that is like a bubble of calm space, if you want to call it that. So that's where you are if you're traveling in a warp drive. In front, it goes down, meaning that you are contracting the space in front of you, and behind it, it goes up, meaning that you're expanding the space in front of you. Cause you're like, you have to imagine it more like a chart than an actual like image or whatever. So that's the idea of a warp drive. Miguel Alcubierre was one of the pioneers of this back in, I think, 1994. Mm-hmm. He wrote a groundbreaking paper on it. So they call it the Alcubierre drive. But again, it's like, it takes, you know, all the energy of the universe to do this. Some refinements have been done over the years at like NASA's Skunk Works. What is it? Eagle Works. NASA's Eagle Works. I can't think of the guy's name who runs Eagle Works. But anyway, they refined it to where all you need is the amount of energy that you would find in Jupiter. So, hey, that's a good step.
We're getting there.
But part of it is also, it's not just that it's energy, it's negative energy, which does not exist. So it's like, how was it explained?
Energy.
No. It's like, the density of energy goes into a negative space kind of thing. You know what I mean? That thing.
Yeah. That thing. Yeah. I'm 100% with you, but for those of you, you know, for those of the, maybe in case there's someone out there that might not quite get it like we do, you know, obviously Joe, you should explain that in great depth now.
Screw you. Anyway, but you're right. I mean, we're laughing about it, but because it's just like, what? Like, how do you even conceptualize that, much less make it happen? So what the big deal was that just came out recently was some scientists, and let me see if I can find in this jumble. Here's maybe this one will be a better one. In a new study by physicist Eric Lenz from Göttingen University in Germany, nailed it. says has a viable solution to this dilemma that is basically it does not rely on negative energy. It's still kind of very hypothetical and out of the way of what we can possibly do right now. But let's see if there's actually a better way to explain this in here. Oh, yeah. So it has to do with the morphology or the shape of the warp bubble. So like we're kind of seeing bubble morphology and spacecraft design. So they have like, you know, the Enterprise and I don't know what that's supposed to be.
Turtle. But space turtle.
Space turtle? Yeah.
Space turtle / skateboard. A skateboarding turtle. Space skateboarding turtle. We all know this. This is normal physics stuff.
Sorry. I know that's totally a new thing. But anyway, so they're basically proposing that it's a different kind of morphology or shape to the warp bubble that has to do with how this works. So right here, I'm just going to read a little bit. It says, he proposes one such way might be able to do this is what he calls a class of hyperfast solitons, a kind of wave that maintains its shape and energy while moving at a constant velocity. These hyperfast soliton solutions can exist within general relativity and are sourced purely from positive energy densities, meaning there's no need to consider exotic negative energy density sources that don't, you know, exist.
That we don't even know exist, yeah.
Yeah.
So, the wave of the magic wand is like, yeah, just do negative energy. Done.
Just do that.
Someone got lazy on their, someone got lazy in their like report, like, I found the solution. Just negative energy. And now this guy's like, wait, I might actually have a legit solution.
Yeah, exactly. So this is, I can never think of her name. Sabine Hassenfelder, is that her name? Yeah, Sabine Hassenfelder. She's a YouTuber and a professor and research fellow at the Frankfurt Institute of Advanced Studies. She's smarter than all of us combined. But she did a video that they linked to here, and obviously we'll have links to this down in the description of this video if you guys want to go check it out. But this kind of shows how the shape of the warp bubble affects how this whole thing works. It's very beyond my ability to comprehend, much less describe, but it's good news if we are ever going to travel to another star, because even at the fastest speeds we could possibly approach, even the closest star would take thousands of years to get there. So, but this would change that.
Yeah. That whole thing, you know, I know, Elon talks about being multiplanetary. Really, it's like not multiplanetary. It's like dual planetary, right? Like there's not really anywhere else we're going to go besides Mars.
We could live in on the atmosphere of Venus in like a cloud city.
Okay,
maybe.
Fine.
Yeah.
You know, triplanetary, I guess we call it. Like but
maybe
it's not
Titan
like we're
in Europa.
But it's not like we're traveling to other galaxies anytime soon.
Right.
Oh, that's right.
Well, definitely not galaxies anytime soon, and definitely not in our time stars.
Yeah, like not even anything. Yeah, even in our own galaxy. Yeah, it's just insanely far. I still love that sci-fi book that I forget what it was called, but they had this thing they developed where you could upload your consciousness to a computer. And essentially that was the idea, is you could upload your consciousness to a computer and send you off into space. So now you could travel for thousands of years. And then like when you wake up or whatever, reanimate your body or like, you know, make a new one out of a cloned cell or something like that, you know? Yeah.
No,
which honestly,
that,
do it.
That doesn't seem more far-fetched than warp drives. So, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I think, the argument that if we ever ran into alien species, that they would actually be mechanical robotic versions of them that maybe have some kind of computer consciousness or something like that, that would be a lot more likely, just because that can survive the vastness of space better than meat bags.
I think it depends on your propulsion system, right? And that's the whole speed of light thing. Like if, as we know of how to travel through our existing space-time, whatever we want to call that, we do not have a way that is even feasible. So you have to go outside of that realm into how do we change space-time itself, or how do we manipulate gravity or something like that, you know?
Yeah. No, like if we understood how gravity works at its fundamental level, which somehow we still don't know, it's just amazing to me.
Yeah.
You know, then you could create a gravity well in front of your vehicle that just pulls you toward it.
That you fall into constantly.
Yeah, you're literally just falling into.
That's the Area 51 stuff, right?
which totally exists.
Well, I mean, that's what Bob Lazar's whole thing was about, right? That he talked
about.
Yeah,
I guess so. Yeah, yeah.
Like, it was a propulsion system that wasn't how we do things. We don't just spit stuff out the back to go forward. Their system created a gravity. Yeah, exactly what you just said. Yeah.
Is that the Tic Tacs? Is that how the Tic Tacs were?
Though that was that wasn't Bob Lazar. That was the other guy, Fraburn or whatever, the pilot that was completely confused by what they saw because they didn't see any propulsion of the system. So they were like, how is it moving? It doesn't make sense. Same with Oumuamua, right? We haven't figured out how or why it was able to do what it did. But also, I guess we had such a glancing look at it that we really didn't have much to go on anyways.
Right. Yeah.
You know?
We have only a very limited amount of data on it, and now it's gone, and all we can do is speculate off of that data we were able to record.
And thank God we can, because that really helps with AdSense on YouTube, man. Who needs data when you have opinions? Come on.
So this podcast has now become Joe Rogan, basically, because we're talking about UFOs and Tic Tacs.
Spotify, just write the check now. Let's go.
Exactly. So anyway, that's exciting to me because if we could see some kind of warp drive in our lifetime, that's game changer. Yeah. And you don't even necessarily have to go faster than the speed of light. You can use a warp drive to go subluminal and get to Mars in 30 minutes instead of, 6 months. Kind of thing.
Yeah. Or even imagine like the realm of, speed of light, 4 years to the closest star. Let's say that we can get to 10% of the speed of light. 40 years? Like that's still like a lot more feasible than 1,000 years,
Yeah.
And
I'll take
it'll still take 30 minutes to go 1 mile in LA traffic. It won't matter. It doesn't matter.
Ain't no warp drive for that.
Well, if you have a warp drive in front of your car, then you'll just suck all the other people into this vac and then you'll just go through them. No big deal.
They will all have warp drives and we'll have a warp drive freeway that's
war.
That is an interesting question. If you were in a car that had a warp drive that was compressing space-time in front of you, would you just be crushing the cars in front of you?
I don't know.
No one.
And then expanding
them
out
the
back.
These are the questions that we need answered.
Yeah.
Leave us a comment. Let us know.
I think there's a lot of people that would do that if they could.
Is that what you guys are working on? Joe, is that your next video?
Weirdly, yes.
Yes. Is it actually?
It's funny you mentioned Oumuamua because my next video is like five space mysteries and that's one of them.
Oh,
cool.
What do they call it? I-2 or something? Or no, I-1. It was the first interstellar object we observed. So the classification is like I-1 or something like that, right?
I think. I don't
And we've since observed another one.
Yeah, it's called Borisov is what they called that one. But it was, whereas Oumuamua, we weren't quite sure. Like it moved like a comet, but it didn't look like a comet. It didn't have a tail or a coma around it or anything.
And also the shape of it didn't match.
I guess, yeah.
It was like
but
flat
Borisov
and
was
weird.
Absolutely a comet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah. So yeah, that's awesome, one of them. I talk about the surface of Venus being like way younger than it should be, and we don't know exactly why. Or don't know exactly how it got that way. Talking about cosmic rays, that neutrino that supposedly proved the existence of a parallel universe, possibly, maybe.
Do you talk about dark matter? That has to be on there, right?
No, I wanted to stay away from like the big cosmological stuff, like Big Bang, dark matter, dark energy and all that, and focus on things that are like kind of right in our backyard that are just little space mysteries that we've never quite figured out.
The going theory I heard on dark matter is it is something in a parallel universe or another universe that is of extreme amounts of gravity. And such extreme amounts of gravity that it shows up in our universe and causes things to move here. And that's like literally the going theory from astrophysicists out there. That's amazing to me that there are, we have to think like that even to explain things that are, that we can see, right? Because dark matter exists because we can't explain the math of certain things. Like we don't fundamentally understand how, like you said, how gravity works yet. Yeah. So, because when you look at certain things, like I think it was, what was her name? She discovered in Andromeda, the stars on the outside of the galaxy, you would think were traveling at a slower speed than the ones close to the center of the galaxy, but they were not. They were traveling at the same speed. So all of a sudden, Newton's laws didn't work. And you're going, what is wrong here? And so I believe that's how we discovered dark matter, right? Or dark energy or something. Was like, there has to be something else pulling it, doing something, affecting it.
Yeah. If I hope I'm not wrong when I say this. I'm sure somebody will correct me. But if I understand it correctly, there's not enough mass in the stars of a galaxy to hold a galaxy together.
Right.
Like the stars should just fly apart, but there's extra gravity from somewhere that's holding it together. And that's kind of what dark matter is. Yeah.
I love that.
Dark energy is why are all these galaxies flying apart from each other and the universe expanding? And that's a whole different thing, but yeah.
So many unanswered questions. I love it.
Yeah. But I stayed away from that in this video. I've talked about that in other places, but.
Well, speaking of energy, my next video is on my new smart electric panel at my house, which is pretty sweet.
So How smart is it?
Ooh, super smart. I even show an example where I was able to change a light switch out in my son's room, and I didn't have to go outside while it was raining to turn off the breaker. I could do it from my phone. And I thought that.
That's cool.
Yeah. I think it's one of those things where it's some pretty cool functionality. It's something that's new, so hopefully people are excited to learn more about it.
Cool.
Huh. That'd be pretty sweet. Dang.
Tim, what you got?
I'm not... Nothing. Remember that video that I'm working on with the belly flop thing? And how it's taken 100 times longer because I'm in the middle of like 40 other different things at this exact moment? Well, now that we've learned so much more about SN10 and stuff, I'm reshooting it.
Of course.
Of course. I've tried so hard to make it. The good thing is, though, I scripted it initially to be as evergreen as I could, but now I see some things that even in my language were not as evergreen as they could be. So this has really forced me to make it, to really study the constraints and the physics behind it, and not so much the actual like day-to-day solutions to the belly flop, right? Because those things will change. I can't tell you what they're going to do for 11. I can't tell you what they're going to do for 15. I can't tell you 2-1 and 1, but I'm going to show you all the options and like why they might be making decisions based on certain options, you know, and what the physics are behind like terminal velocity and gravity drag. And came up with a really fun example and shot this with my friend Trevor Malman, where I realized that, you know, if we've talked about suicide burns before on the show, or gravity burns. Suicide burn or hover slam, you know, where when you're trying to land a rocket, it's if your thrust to weight ratio is higher than 1, you really only have 1 chance to get it right, because you can't like lower your throttle enough to, you know, if you stop too early, like say you stop 100 meters off the ground, you can't lower your throttle. So you can't like go down anymore. Right. And I know that sounds terrible and terrifying, but then I realized like, oh wait, we do have a hover slam literally almost every day. Most of us do. Every day, every time you approach a stop sign, if you go and touch your brake pedal and never let go of your brakes and never like give it, you know, your accelerator pedal again, you're hover slamming. It's not that hard.
I mean, Tesla Autopilot does that to me when I go underneath a bridge.
Hover slams. Yeah. But yeah, it's the same thing. You know, you're in that case, your brakes are your rocket engine. And the more you apply your brake, the more you're throttling your rocket engine. You know, it's the exact same thing in that scenario. And I realized, oh, we actually are pretty good at this.
Man, I really miss the 90s bands here. Hover slams, suicide burns. Man, those were good. Remember that?
Right.
I saw them Lollapalooza.
Great bands.
Yeah.
But this is funny. Casper and Andy are talking about this in Discord, saying, well, your throttle can't go below 40%. I assume neither Casper nor Andy have ever driven a Tesla with maximum regenerative braking, where you do have a minimum throttle setting of about probably 50%, 40%. Like it breaks you. As soon as you let off the accelerator, you've turned on that engine. You're committed to stopping. And if you did it too early, you have to get back on the accelerator pedal, which would be the same as turning off your rocket engine. So we actually use that as an example of like, we can even simulate a minimum throttle setting And then I, at the same time, like, yeah, you rarely would slam on your brakes, but I don't think they're also intending to ever slam on their throttles at 100% either. So it's a pretty good analogy, actually, and I'm really excited about it.
Reverse impulse. Answered.
Yeah. It'll be fun. Nice. So we shot that and added it to the script, and it's going to make it, I think it just really helps you drill in a way to practice and understand the physics yourself every day. So I'm really excited.
Everyday yeah, cool. physics. Got it. That's awesome.
The cool. everyday yeah. physicist.
There you go, baby.
Ooh.
Well, I'm excited. Hopefully I'll actually be able to get back to work on that after this week, because this week is the thing I can't talk about.
Ooh, okay.
And maybe I can talk about it soon. So, yeah.
But you keep teasing it.
Mm. I know.
Yep. All right, guys. We'll see you then in
our ludicrous future.
Turn it off.
Make it stop. Hey guys, thanks so much for watching and for listening. We really do appreciate it. We couldn't do it without you.
Yeah, and if you want more of us, you can consider becoming a Patreon member, where you can get early access to episodes, you can listen to us record live, join our awesome Discord community, or get your name in the show credits.
So head over to olfpod.com/Patreon to learn more. Thanks, everyone.
Thanks, everyone.